Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. No one starts out as an alcoholic, and no one would choose the bottle over family, friends, career, love, success, relationships, or life, for that matter. Alcoholism is not a choice, but an addiction. And while some individuals can imbibe responsibly and never develop a problem, others have what the NIH calls an alcohol use disorder. For them, alcohol consumption is alcohol abuse, and this disorder is both a personal health tragedy and a public health crisis. Alcohol misuse costs the U.S. nearly $250,000 each year.
Some individuals worry about alcoholism running in their families. Others struggle with it but are still in hiding. Some who've gone through treatment are terrified of relapse, and some who've never had a problem and never will don't understand. Any discussion of alcoholism has to address these perspectives and more. That's why we've reached out to one of the nation's leading authorities on the interface between primary care and addiction medicine. Dr. Patrick O'Connor is a professor of general medicine at Yale School of Medicine and chief of general internal medicine at the Primary Care Center at Yale New Haven Hospital. He's written extensively on alcoholism and opioid addiction.
Welcome to Take Care, Dr. O'Connor. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
How would you define alcoholism?
Well, it's interesting. I would prefer not to define it, and here's why. Alcoholism is an old term that is very imprecise. There was a group many years ago that developed a definition of alcoholism as a primary chronic disease with genetic, psychosocial, and environmental factors, which is often progressive and fatal and characterized by impaired control over drinking, preoccupation with the drug alcohol, the use of alcohol despite consequences, and distortion of thinking, mostly denial. So that might sound like a precise definition, but what's happened over time is that the term has been, in many ways, misconstrued or misused, and it also, from many perspective of many patients in the public, has a stigma or negative connotation associated with it. So it's that imprecision and that stigma, which in my experience, I tried to avoid using that term. I think the more accurate term to use is alcohol use disorder, which is the officially recognized terminology of the DSM, which is the sort of source of how substance use and mental health diagnoses are made. And the disease, alcohol use disorder, does have a specific set of criteria, 11 criteria, which make up that definition. And depending on how many criteria one has, you either don't have the disease or have mild, moderate, or severe alcohol use disorder. So I prefer to use alcohol use disorder rather than alcoholism.
One of the tough things, I would guess, is that there is a lot of social drinking that's perfectly acceptable. There's a spectrum, in other words, and I'm wondering about that spectrum from your point of view as an expert on this. There's social drinking. People might have wine with dinner. They look forward to wine with dinner. They may crave the wine with dinner because they're used to having it. And then, as you know, there's a spectrum of people who can't live without alcohol. So how does a person know when they've crossed the line and have alcohol use disorder?
So it's a great question. So there is a spectrum of alcohol consumption in the country, right? So as it turns out, most Americans use some alcohol, although, you know, there's a substantial minority who don't use alcohol at all. So let's sort of move up the spectrum from abstention. There's this concept of moderate drinking, which is sort of an imprecise concept, but it's defined somewhat by another concept called at-risk drinking. So at-risk drinking refers to the consumption of an amount of alcohol that puts an individual at risk for alcohol-related health problems. And the NIAAA, which is a branch of the NIH, which focuses on alcohol, has developed specific criteria for at-risk drinking. At-risk drinking in men is defined as greater than 14 drinks per week or greater than 4 drinks in one day. For women, it's defined as greater than 7 drinks per week or greater than 3 drinks per day. Now, an important thing to note about this concept of at-risk drinking, it doesn't mean that if someone has an at-risk level of drinking that they necessarily have alcohol-related problems. It just means that they're drinking at an amount which puts them at risk for alcohol-related problems. The same way in which if someone's cholesterol is a little bit elevated, their risk for heart disease is elevated, but it doesn't mean they have heart disease. So we really think of these thresholds as, from the perspective of a primary care physician, when patients are drinking above these thresholds, it's a time to talk to them about the threshold and help them think through what some of the potential health effects of drinking above those thresholds could be. And we think of below at-risk drinking as so-called moderate drinking, but once you reach that threshold, it's considered at risk. Then above there, when you start to have actual harms, that's when these 11 criteria for alcohol use disorder come to play. So, for example, some of the criteria involve, using alcohol in larger amounts than you intend, or wanting to cut down on alcohol or quit but not being able to do that. And there are several other criteria as well. That's when we start to think someone's going from an at-risk situation, moving closer to what we consider an alcohol use disorder problem.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And our guest today is Dr. Patrick O'Connor. He's the Dan and Amanda Adams Professor of General Medicine and Chief of General Internal Medicine at Yale University School of Medicine. And we're talking about the topic of alcohol use disorder, what people commonly refer to as alcoholism. But Dr. O'Connor explained why alcohol use disorder is a more appropriate term to use today. In terms of this, Dr. O'Connor, is there such a thing as a genetic predisposition, a family component?
Absolutely. So we know for a fact that having a family member who has alcohol use disorder puts individuals in that family at higher risk for developing that disorder over time or having it actually at that time than if there was not such a family member present. So genetics is very important, and like other diseases, the genetic signal might be either non-existent, or relatively weak, or quite strong. That's why in some families you'll see an occasional family member with alcohol use disorder. In other families, you'll see lots of family members with alcohol use disorder. The same can be said for cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. It's a very similar a pattern of inheritance in terms of intensity.
Now, if you have a concern about yourself or a friend or a family member, how do you intervene and who should this person seek help from first? And then we want to talk to you about some of the current treatments that have been proven to be most effective.
Yeah, so the first question is, who do you turn to? You know, obviously, it depends on whether it's the individual themselves are concerned about or a family member. There's lots of information on the web that people can look at to try to get some direction around this. The website I refer people most often to is the website for the NIAAA. It's NIAAA.gov, I believe. They, in addition to having information for scientists and researchers, they also have links that get you to information for the general public as well. My hope is that one of the primary sources that patients and families, patients especially, but families can turn to is their own primary care physician. A lot of my work over the years has been trying to educate and cajole and encourage primary care physicians to take a more active role in both identifying and treating patients who have alcohol and other substance use problems, so that a well-educated primary care physician, let's take it from the perspective of the individual patient, for example, a well-educated primary care physician should be able to recognize actual or potential alcohol problems in their patients without the patient specifically asking for help. You know, there are certain questions we should be asking routinely of our patients that might identify a patient who's consuming too much alcohol or having alcohol-related problems. But beyond that, to get to the question you asked, if a patient approached their primary care physician or any physician for that matter or other healthcare professional, They should have the wherewithal to be able to provide guidance both in person, directly, but also provide connection to resources in the community that could be helpful. A lot of the work I've done over the years has been trying to get the healthcare system generally, primary care physicians especially, to be a better resource for patients and families in this regard.
And so let's go to that next step in the few minutes that we have left. What are the most successful treatments as an observer and somebody who deals with this all the time? We know about the effectiveness of, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous in that it's a support group situation. But now that we know more about brain chemistry and addiction, are there other types of treatment that have been proven to be helpful and successful in the last few years?
Yes. So here's how I would think about treatment for all substance use disorders, and we'll focus specifically on alcohol. So treatment always involves some form of counseling. The counseling component for alcohol in particular has been well researched and developed so that there are very structured counseling approaches that begin with brief advice that any healthcare provider can provide that helps patients identify the fact that they're drinking too much and gives them advice on where their drinking is causing problems and advice to cut down on that drinking, all the way up to more detailed treatments that includes special counseling such as motivational enhancement therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, or 12-step facilitation. Those more detailed and enhanced counseling strategies are typically found not so much in a primary care setting, but in a treatment program setting where a psychologist, a psychiatrist, or a counselor trained in those specific techniques can provide that help. And there's great evidence to show that those approaches can help people cut back on their drinking and stop drinking.
Is that an inpatient? I'm sorry if I missed it, but is that an inpatient situation where you have that whole team of people that are helping?
So it can be inpatient or outpatient. It depends on the severity of the problem. For people who have relatively healthy with relatively little other comorbid issues going on, such as active psychiatric disease, for example, or unstable medical problems, and this is the vast majority of patients, they can be managed as an outpatient. They don't need to be in an inpatient setting. The inpatient setting is reserved for people who've failed outpatient treatment, or who are unstable. They're having severe withdrawal, they're having active psychiatric disease or medical conditions that require an inpatient setting. In that situation, inpatient setting is a better place to be. But both settings, inpatient and outpatient, avail patients to these standardized counseling approaches that have been proven to be highly effective in terms of helping people cut down or stop drinking. The other approach, so we have counseling on one hand. The other approach is medication. So the FDA has now approved three different medications for treating alcohol use disorder. Disulfiram, which is also called Antabuse, which was approved back in the 1960s. Naltrexone, which was approved back in the 1990s. And then an injectable form of naltrexone that only has to be given once a month was approved in 2006. And then acamprosate is the third medication, a medication that was used in Europe for many years but was approved by the FDA in about 2004. So these are three types of medications that have been demonstrated to help people both cut down in some cases and stop using alcohol in other cases get them in a healthier state. Are these medications silver bullets? No. So there's no such thing as a silver bullet for addiction where you just give someone a medication and the next day their addiction is treated. But these medications, if we think of addiction in the chronic disease model, like diabetes, like hypertension, like cancer, like heart disease, these medications are as effective as many or most medications we use to treat those other chronic conditions, the antihypertensive, the diabetes medications. So they can have a mild, moderate, or sometimes profound effect on the health of patients. It depends on the individual patients. Very often, it's a combination of those two things then, counseling plus medication, which really provides the foundation for how alcohol use disorder is best treated.
Dr. Patrick O'Connor is the Dan and Amanda Adams Professor of General Medicine and Chief of General Internal Medicine at Yale University School of Medicine. He's written and published extensively on alcoholism and opioid addiction, and we will be posting the website that you referenced during the interview on our webpage. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us at Take Care.
It was my pleasure. Bye-bye.